also come closer. There's some seats closer. Well, I'll try and speak loud. I will also try and speak slowly. I have a tendency to start slowly and then I continue very fast, and I realize that English is probably not your first language and you don't have many classes in English, so I'll make particular efforts to be slow and articulate. Also, you will see I will sometimes be a bit abstract, but I promise you some examples will come. But if it does get too quick or too abstract, please interrupt me, and at any time, I welcome that. So as was kindly said by Carlos, I'm working at the Bargo Foundation, which is an organization based in Berlin, even though I'm French originally. And our business at the Bargo Foundation is that we are located at the intersection between research practice, education and grant making on conflict transformation. And I'm directing the research program, but because we have that interesting constellation, I think a lot of my work is building on what my practitioner colleagues are doing, and is also then feeding into their work. And also we have a lot of interactions with the policy world, so we always try and have a nice cycle of practice, research and policy advice. Which I think is quite unique, and that's why I've been there for 11 years, and that's why I still continue enjoying working there. The way we define conflict transformation is, so I'll come to that in a minute. For us, conflict transformation is a specific approach to intervention in conflict, armed or unarmed conflict. And it has a number of specificities. I would say the first one is that we consider that conflict is an inherent and inevitable process of human relations. And so what conflict transformation is all about is the transformation of destructive and violent conflicts into constructive non-violent conflicts. So it's not about avoiding and eliminating conflict, but about avoiding and limiting violence. Another particularity is that conflict transformation is very much trying to tackle all dimensions of conflict and violence. And I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the famous Galtung ABC triangle. I guess you are, but just in case, as a quick reminder, conflict at the surface, conflict have a lot to do with violent behavior, warfare, and etc. And that's the top of the iceberg. So that's the B, behavior. Attitude, this is the culture of violence that justifies active and direct violence. And then the C, which Galtung calls contradiction, this is about structural root causes of violence, whether it's about inequality, patriarchy, exploitation, colonialism, and so forth. And so conflict transformation is trying to address all three sides and to transform violent behavior into non-violent, peaceful behavior, to transform conflict-prone attitudes into processes of reconciliation, transitional justice, and so forth, and cultural peace, and then to transform structural violence into processes of democratization, equality, justice, and so forth. Another particularity of conflict transformation is that we very much try to embody another triangle, which is very core in the field of peace research, which is the Lederach triangle. Probably many of you know this triangle too, but just in case. What John Paul Lederach says is that there's three levels of society, of decision-making and of activism and of social interaction. So the track one is, you know, the track of top decision-makers at the state level. The track two has to deal with leaders in a society, whether that's civil society leaders, whether that's the church, whether that's the business community. And then the track three is about interactions at the grassroots between civil society activists and the people in general. And so what Lederach says is that conflict transformation can happen from the top down. So having negotiations in Cuba, let's say, between leaders of an armed group and a government, and then somehow it trickles down by informing the people and trying to get them involved through various channels. But conflict transformation can also happen from the bottom up. And there's a lot of grassroots struggles as well as dialogue interactions that can inspire leaders. And so in order for conflict transformation to be effective, it has to happen both ways. So that's, again, like an important core of conflict transformation theory. And I would maybe add a last one, in terms of the methodology of conflict transformation research. In most of the research that we do, we try to embody a participatory way of doing research. And as much as possible, we see the objects of research as being the subjects of research. So that means that we do research with people in conflict. And as has been mentioned before, for instance, a lot of the work that I have done on armed groups and their transitions, we have worked with members of armed groups or with former veterans from armed movements, asking them to reflect critically on their own experiences of transitioning from underground militant activities to peaceful political activities. And we do research with them, and then we make that research available to others, where we facilitate a peer exchange between, let's say, former armed group leaders and movements that are now in negotiations, so that that space can be used for mutual learning. And we are just there to facilitate that exchange. We're not there as the experts that will come with the knowledge. So that's, in a nutshell, how we understand conflict transformation. Now, the topic of today is based on a complicated title, which is basically the draft title of a paper that I wrote and that will be published soon, which is exactly trying to understand in a more systematic manner what are the respective roles of peace building and nonviolent civil resistance in processes of conflict transformation. As you will see, the reason why I have here this overlapping circles is that peace building and civil resistance have a lot in common. They share mutual goals and they have a lot of means in common. But there's also a number of distinctions that I think we as researchers and as activists and as practitioners need to better understand in order to see how they can complement each other for more effective conflict transformation. So the report is resting on three basic assumptions. The first one is that, as I just said, civil resistance and peace building, and I'll define these terms in a minute, they share a common commitment to social change and increased justice through peaceful means, but they are rooted in different approaches to conflict transformation. The second basic assumption is that these two fields, and I call them, after Lederach, the revolutionary approach to conflict transformation, which is civil resistance, and the resolutionary approach, which is peace building, they have developed kind of in parallel and kind of in mutual ignorance. So civil resistance, which is a much more recent field, I would say, has developed its set of scholars and activists and circles of knowledge and in the growing numbers also master's programs and schools. And the peace-building community, which is much, much bigger, better funded, and better known, has also developed its own distinct set of research and practice. And so, therefore, the third basic assumption is that in acute conflicts that are characterized by strong power asymmetry between the have and the have-nots, between the elites and the people, or what we call the top, well, the elites and the underdog. In such conflicts, in order to have a just and sustainable peace, we need both sets of strategies. and they need to be employed in a coherent and complementary fashion. So the whole point of that paper and this presentation is to show you how I developed this idea of a complementary approach. First, I will go into the definitions and kind of a comparison of what I mean with peace building, what I mean with civil resistance. And then I will use a specific model to show you how in practice, at different stages of transformation of conflict, they can complement each other. So I apologize for this quite complex definitions. I've already defined conflict transformation. Maybe I'll just read them for now, and then I'll kind of explain what I mean by these definitions. So civil resistance is defined here as an extra-institutional strategy to wage conflict. And in these strategies, the primary agency is played by organized grassroots movements that use various strategically sequenced and planned nonviolent tactics that range from strikes and boycotts to marches, demonstrations, non-cooperation, self-organizing, and constructive resistance. And the goal of these tactics are to fight perceived injustice without the threat or without the use of violence. So this is how I would define civil resistance. And I'll come back to these dimensions in a minute. Now, peace building is, I think, much harder to define, and it has been used in many different dimensions and different ways, sometimes quite contradictory to each other. So in that paper, I'm trying to use a quite broad and all-encompassing definition of peace building. So I describe it as local, state-based, or international strategies which are used to mitigate imminent, ongoing, or past violent conflicts and to promote a lasting and sustainable peace. So peace building can happen, as I said, either through top-down or bottom-up dynamics. And the main methods that are used in peace building to promote peaceful relations between parties to a conflict include dialogue, negotiation, mediation, as well as methods to build or to rebuild institutions for peace. So now that I have told you the all-encompassing definitions, maybe I'll go a little bit more in detail as to what I mean with these terms and what do they have in common and where are the main distinctions. So the first, the top layer there is actually the commonalities between these two strategies. So the commonalities are that both peace building and civil resistance are orientated towards the search for just peace by peaceful means. So the normative end goal is to look for a situation of a positive peace. So peace at the attitudinal level, at the structural level, and at the direct conflict level. And how this is reached, the means to reach positive peace is through the opposition to physical violence. So all of the means that are used by these different these different sets of strategies are non-violent or peaceful. So why this is quite general. Now, what are the distinctions? So I don't know how familiar you are with civil resistance as a theory and as a practice. I'm sure when you hear the term civil resistance, the main names that will come to your mind are names like Martin Luther King or Gandhi. Those are like the historical developers, I would say, of the theory of nonviolence. But more recently, there's been a revival of interest in nonviolence as a practice, thanks to the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, in Central Asia during the early 2000s, as well as the Arab revolutions that followed a decade later. In all these cases, what happened was essentially massive street protests that led to the resignation or the overthrow of leaders that were considered to be corrupt or to be authoritarian. So that's the main image that usually one associates with civil resistance. A fundamental component of civil resistance is that it's oriented towards justice and against the status quo. So it's directed against oppression, domination, and other forms of injustice that are maintained or that are supported by the state or by elites, social elites, economic elites, cultural elites. So a large segment of the scholarship and the research on civil resistance focuses on nonviolent struggles against dictatorship, but also there are other accounts of the use of civil resistance against other forms of injustice, such as struggles for national liberation, like what can think of Palestine or Tibet or Western Sahara or West Papua, but also nonviolent struggles for land rights, like in Brazil or in India, or nonviolent struggles against corruption in many countries, or women's nonviolent struggles against patriarchal systems, for instance. So civil resistance is oriented towards justice, against status quo, and it can be described as a form of extra-institutional contentious method of collective action. So often, especially in authoritarian regimes, civil resistance is an illegal form of action. And many scholars define it as a functional equivalent to armed resistance. Basically, again, in a situation of oppression or authoritarianism or inequality, opposition groups can use armed or unarmed means of resistance. The only difference, I would say, is in the use or the absence of direct violence. But that's why some people say it's a functional equivalent, because it's trying to achieve the same goals through different means. And finally, the agents of change. So who are the actors, the agents that are involved in civil resistance? Well, it's normally grassroots activists, but it can also be their allies within institutions, where they manage to bring the pillars of power, as we call it, towards them. So when members of the police, members of the army, members of the administration start to join a nonviolent struggle, civil resistance can also involve external actors, third-party actors that accompany them to protect them, or that conduct advocacy campaigns abroad in support of their struggles. So this is, in a nutshell, what I mean with civil resistance. Now, peace building, I think you are probably more familiar with peace building. The way that it's usually defined traditionally has come from the Agenda for Peace that was published by Boutros Ghali in 1992. And in this original definition, peace building was quite narrowly defined as a method of post-war intervention that was aimed to strengthen peace and to reduce chances of relapse into violence, primarily through UN-led operations. So that's the classical narrow definition, I would say, of peace building. But since the 1990s, the field of peace building has expanded quite beyond that narrow definition. Now a lot of scholars use the term peace building to not only mean UN-led, top-down, externally imposed or influenced interventions, but also locally-led, bottom-up forms of peace building. The term peace building is now also used actually across the different stages of conflict transformation. So some scholars use the term peace building to refer to conflict prevention, early warning kind of activities, or mediation, negotiation, as well as post-war DDR, demobilization and reintegration, or security sector reform. So basically any form of intervention in a conflict which does not involve the use of force can be referred as peace building. So that's why actually I've struggled a bit with this paper, and it has taken me a lot of time to work on it because I couldn't decide like how to define peace building and what kind of boundaries to use to define it. One key feature of peace building is that across all of the different methods that I've just named, one commonality is that peace building is a method that is used to mitigate tension and to mitigate adversity. The aim is to de-escalate the level of violent conflict, and this comes then in contrast to civil resistance methods, which are aimed at intensifying conflict towards its necessary resolution. I think, as I've said already, peace building approaches involve multi-tracks. It can happen top-down or bottom-up. But one other important feature is that usually peace building practitioners define themselves as impartial third parties. So if you remember what I said before about civil resistance, it focuses on pro-justice intervention, anti-status quo, so it takes an ethical, normative approach to conflict, whereas peace-building takes not a neutral, but I would say an impartial, or what we call a multi-partial approach to conflict. What we could oppose to this idea of an impartial approach is that in situations of acute asymmetry between powerful elites and excluded minorities, or even disempowered majorities, in many cases, actually a majority is out of power, and it's a minority that is leading power. This impartial approach might actually lead to a worsening of the conflict, or to a neglect of situations of injustice. And what I found is that many peace-building approaches, even though they stress the importance of resolving the structural root causes of conflict, in reality, they tend to be implemented as kind of technical reforms in a specific domain, and they don't necessarily challenge the ingrained structural system of injustice. The role of civil resistance has been so far barely acknowledged in the peace-building literature, so there's a lot of room for bringing to the fore of peace building the importance of civil resistance and the complementarity that civil resistance strategies can contribute to peace building in order to lead to sustained conflict transformation. So what I want to do now is to go a little bit more concrete after all the theory and the big words I've just been using, and to show you concretely what this complementarity can mean. And for this, I am using a diagram that was originally conceived by Adam Curl, actually who created the Peace Studies Department in Bradford. He was the founder of that department. He was a Quaker scholar practitioner. And he designed that diagram in order to show what are the stages of transformation in situations of acute power imbalance. So what are the stages that need to be passed through for an imbalanced relationship to be transformed into fair, equal relationships? So there's four main stages. The stage of latent conflict, and I'll describe them in a minute. The stage of overt conflict, the stage of conflict settlement, and the stage of sustainable peace. These different stages are characterized by different degrees of imbalance. So basically, in order for a conflict to be transformed, it has to pass by or to transform from a situation of an imbalanced power relation to a balanced power relation. But also the parties have to become aware of their situation of imbalance. So the first stage of latent conflict is a stage when there is a situation of a structural violence, there is injustice in society, but the underdog, let's say, might not necessarily be aware of that situation of injustice. And therefore, in that stage, conflict transformation strategies need to awaken conflict parties to this situation of imbalance, the need to address structural violence, and to avoid violent conflict at the same time. So I think that civil resistance methods are very effective at helping conflicts that are in that early stage through what Paulo Freire calls conscientization of the underdog, so that they develop an awareness of the need to address and to restore equity. So the use of protest methods, persuasion methods, such as petitions, marches, displaying national symbols, cultural symbols, these are all tools that can be used for mobilizing an aggrieved community to the need for restoring equity. And so here I use the example of South Africa and the Freedom Charter that was drafted in the 1950s. So what happened was that the Congress of the People was a situation of 50,000 volunteers that were sent into townships, into the countryside, and to collect freedom demands from the people of South Africa. And this process of going to the community, mobilizing the people and collecting these demands led to the writing of the Freedom Charter, which called an end of racist white supremacy. It called for the establishment of democracy, the protection of human rights, land reforms, labor rights, and so forth. And that initial act of mobilization has inspired two generations of liberation activists that first mobilized through nonviolent means of struggle until there was a turn to armed resistance in the early 60s. And then again a new wave of nonviolent resistance in the 1980s. So that was the first stage. And here I'm showing basically that nonviolent resistance helps the underdog to understand that there is a situation of contradiction and conflict and that something has to be done. The second stage is the stage of overt conflict. And here it's a stage characterized by still some level of power imbalance, but the parties to the conflict have developed a high level of awareness of the conflicting interests and the needs. So the tensions that were previously covered up by the powerful or met with apathy, resignation by the powerless, have been brought to the surface. And the conflict has become manifest. So this is the stage of empowerment of aggrieved groups through confrontation, whether it's violent or non-violent confrontation. And so what I try to show here in that stage is that civil resistance offers an effective and a constructive approach to combating acute injustice and power imbalance without the use of violence. When I looked at the different tools that are used by the peacebuilding literature to describe the functions of civil society in peacebuilding, I find lots of tools like protection, monitoring, advocacy, facilitation, but I don't find any tools that are related to this confrontation, especially nonviolent confrontation, so that underdog can redress situations of power imbalance. So here I think civil resistance is a very useful complement to peace building. It embodies the prosecution of necessary conflicts via unarmed, nonviolent means. And that's why the term nonviolent struggle, I think, is good, because it points to the inherent conflicting dimension of civil resistance, so that conflicts can be addressed. What I find as well is that civil resistance methods helps to create a condition for peace building to become possible by avoiding violent forms of confrontation. And nonviolent movements usually develop a whole array of training programs and manuals to maintain a nonviolent discipline. So the aim is to prevent violence internally. But there's also a number of means that are used to try and de-escalate inter-party violence. So when a civil resistance campaign mobilizes, usually violent repressions follows by the state. But I would still describe nonviolent resistance as a self-limiting conflict strategy that tried to deter the escalation of violence towards mass atrocities. And in the paper, I use the example of Timor-Leste, and I show how the struggle for self-determination of the Timor-Leste people by using primarily nonviolent means helped to prevent a situation of genocide by the Indonesian army and therefore prevented the escalation of violence. Civil resistance is also used by communities in war-torn societies by opposing all forms and sources of violence. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the example of peace communities in Colombia, but also in Philippines and elsewhere. These are grassroots initiatives that mobilize against the violence of the state and against the violence of insurgents. And these initiatives show that it's possible to engage effectively in organized, nonviolent forms of conflict, even in the midst of armed conflict. So again, here in that stage, I try to show how civil resistance can be used to escalate, or let's say intensify, the level of conflict, but without leading to violence, genocide, and so forth. For me, the two most interesting stages are the next two. The third stage of conflict settlement is reached when confrontation results in a shift of power relations towards greater balance between the parties, when the weaker party becomes a necessary partner in dialogue. This is when negotiation, dialogues, and mediation starts, so that the parties can then resolve their conflict through conciliatory means of peace building. And what I try to show here is that civil resistance can be seen as a pre-conciliation or pre-negotiation strategy, because it helps negotiations to lead to sustainable outcomes. I use the example of Poland. The Polish Solidarity protests in the 1980s, Solidarność. This example shows how the use of strikes, demonstrations, were helping to put pressure on the Polish authorities to accept that there has to be a dialogue between the state and society. And the use of civil resistance methods forced the state to recognize that that dialogue had to happen in a kind of equal, balanced way. Talking about women, another example would be the struggle that women in Liberia fought for the end of civil war. In 2003, a group of Liberian women launched massive protests against the fighting in the conflict between various armed groups. They forced the president, Taylor, to attend peace talks and to invite armed groups for peace talks in Ghana. What they did is that these women, they traveled to the negotiation site in Ghana. They staged a sit-in outside of the presidential palace where the negotiations were happening, and they said, "We're not leaving until you sign a peace accord." After a few days, eventually the peace accord was signed. And what that shows is that when civil society organizes through civil resistance, it can force equal negotiations to happen. Maybe I will give you another example, which is the one that I know best, which is the example of Nepal. In Nepal, there was a 10-year armed insurgency that was fought by the Maoist armed group against the state. Now, after 10 years of armed struggle, the Maoists and the state reached a situation of status quo, or what we call mutually halting stalemate, or basically none of the parties was winning. Now, what happened was that the Maoists decided to leave their weapons aside and to join a massive civil resistance campaign in the capital, where millions of Nepalese marched to the capital. And that civil resistance movement forced the king to resign, and forced the mainstream political parties to sit at the negotiation table with the insurgency. And so here again, this example shows that civil resistance was used as a pre-negotiation strategy to force the parties to come to the table in a kind of equal, balanced fashion and to sign a peace accord. That, I think, brought a lot of massive changes to Nepal by instituting a new republic, a constituent assembly that led to massive structural reforms into the country. What I also show is that peace-building methods are an important complement to civil resistance because it helps to transform polarized conflict scenarios into win-win scenarios. When nonviolent resistance is used in situations of acute polarization, let's say a division between ethno-political groups, or when conflicts involve issues that are not negotiable, like issues around identity, issues around the survival of a community, a transformation of power relations through civil resistance is not enough to come to a positive peace. And dialogue becomes necessary to facilitate the articulation of the needs and interests of all parties into mutually acceptable solutions. And here I use the example of Tunisia, and which I compare with the situation of Egypt after the 2011 revolution. What Tunisia shows is that when civil resistance through the Jasmine Revolution, as it is called, when the Tunisian people forced the government to resign, because civil resistance was followed by a very inclusive national dialogue, whereby the leaders of that movement sat together and initiated a dialogue around what kind of society do we want, what kind of democracy do we want to build. This helped the civil resistance gains to be sustained and for the democracy to become sustained. Whereas in Egypt, the revolution was not followed by such an inclusive national dialogue, and I would argue that this is one of the main reasons why the gains of the nonviolent revolution were lost very quickly. So here, what I wanted to show was that civil resistance is an important pre-negotiation strategy to equalize power relations before dialogue, but inclusive dialogue is an important complement because it helps to translate gains made through protest into mutually acceptable outcomes, and it leads to more sustainable peace. And I'll finish with the last stage, which is the stage of sustainable peace, actually. Here, what I try to show is two things. Firstly, I think civil resistance continues to play a very important role in post-conflict societies. What usually happens is that a peace accord or a new constitution might be very progressive and inclusive, but the implementation stage is always imperfect. Usually, a peace accord will lead into some form of reintegration of combatants, some form of legal rights being conceded by the old elites. But in terms of the implementation of the more tricky parts of peace accords, like transitional justice, like changing a culture of violence that benefits elites and the status quo, or in terms of transforming the real socio-economic power, changing land property and so forth, the implementation rarely happens. And so I think there is a need to try and uncover better the role of civil resistance in that stage for formally disempowered groups that have now been at the forefront of change to maintain that momentum, to make sure that the changes that have been put on paper will actually be implemented. To give you a very concrete example, last December I co-organized some trainings in Nepal with activists that were comprised by transitional justice right groups, so victims that have lost relatives or that have been injured or that have lost property in the war and that are demanding justice. and that justice is not being met. So there's been a couple of commissions set up by the state, but these commissions are progressing very slowly. They are dominated by political interests and not really by experts and real change. And we also met with former combatants that have been disqualified from DDR processes, from reintegration benefits, that were disqualified for all of that and that are now in a really precarious situation. So all of these are groups that were supposed to have their needs met with the peace accord, but that are now in an even more precarious situation than they were during the conflict. So what we try to show these groups is that there are ways through which they can mobilize non-violently to demand that the state fulfills its obligations towards them. And they have started to develop very creative civil resistance campaigns from encircling the offices of the Maoists that are now in power to force them to implement the reforms that they had committed themselves to implement, or doing human chains, like also marginalized groups in the Terai, in the south of the country, have organized human chains to demand their rights to be met in the constitution and to demonstrate that they don't want to do that through rioting, they want to do that through non-violent means. And so, as I said, I think civil resistance continues to play an important role in the post-war context to make sure that the situation doesn't go back to kind of basically sweeping the conflict under the carpet. What I also find is that peace building plays an important role in making sure that the gains that are made through civil resistance are institutionalized and implemented. A civil resistance movement, because it has very democratic features, it tends to bring about democratic leaders like Lech Walesa in Poland or Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar. These leaders that become the new state, that become part of the new state, can help through peace building methods to make sure that the non-violent societies that civil resistance campaign was trying to embody and to prefigure will actually become a reality. So here I'm trying to show again that both civil resistance and peace building play complementary roles in that last phase, and that in order for peace to be sustained and in order for disgruntled grievance groups that think that their demands have not been met, in order to prevent these groups from joining extremist violent groups, civil resistance is a way of channeling this, these emotions and these grievances into constructive means. So what I do in the conclusion to that report, I try and understand, so what are main takeaways for different communities? And because I think the peace-building community still lacks awareness of what civil resistance means and what gains it can bring to their work, I focus on that community and trying to understand how can the peace-building community be made more aware of civil resistance. So I identify some global agenda priorities where civil resistance can be kind of added in. For instance, I'm sure you're aware of this globally embraced responsibility to protect imperative that encourages international early action to prevent genocides and to prevent mass atrocities. So what I'm arguing is that this responsibility to protect should also encompass a responsibility to accompany and to support grassroots nonviolent movements that rise in opposition to systematic violations of human rights. And so the international community should not only have a duty to intervene through humanitarian action, but to support the actual agency that is already there in society and that is trying to tackle the root causes of human rights violations. What I also argue is that when preventive diplomacy fails to stop the escalation of a violent warfare, peace-building actors, development donors, agencies should be encouraged to identify, recognize, and support what I would call non-violent flanks, which usually operate alongside armed groups.
there's in a situation of armed conflict, usually armed groups, they take the headlines of international media coverage, but there's always social movements that are active alongside these armed groups and are pursuing the same goals but through different means. And I'm trying to argue for international donors and agencies to recognize this non-violent flanks and to develop different forms of diplomatic tools to protect, support, and accompany them. Finally, I also argue that it's high time for donor agencies, diplomats, international organizations to move away from internationally driven efforts to restore or to impose a peace in a local conflict, and instead to adopt a more light footprint approach that is geared towards helping communities to build their own capacities for constructive conflict transformation through the combined power of civil resistance as well as dialogue and peace building. So I hope I was not too theoretical, but I think now is the time for you to challenge me and to ask me, okay, what exactly did you mean and what does that mean in real life? So I very much welcome that interaction. Thank you.